far, no arrests have been made.
30-year-old Travis Alexander was a devout Mormon and a well-known motivational speaker. Detectives are now pointing the finger at Jody Arias.
Inside the investigation into the killing of Gabby Petito, the FBI say her former boyfriend, Ryan Laundrie, admitted to killing Petito in a notebook.
Welcome to this episode of Murder, Pray, Love. We are going to be recapping the trial. The trial has finally started and gotten underway. Jury selection started on April 3rd and went all the way through the 7th. It took the first full week to actually get a jury settled. And there really wasn't much of anything that happened during the week. They just asked the same questions and kind of gave scenarios. One scenario that they did is called the cookie analogy. The cookie analogy is when they asked potential jurors that, hey, if you have a kid and you have a cookie jar with a cookie in it, you close the cookie jar, you tell the kid, don't eat the cookie. You walk out of the room and you come back and the kid has crumbs all over their face. The cookie jar is open. Yes or no, did the kid eat the cookie? Well, a lot of jurors, potential jurors, I should say, actually said, yes, I do believe that the kid ate the cookie. Some people did say that they would have to ask the kid if they ate it, and others said that they would have to actually see the kid eat the cookie to believe that they ate the cookie. And the reason why this question comes into play, it is speculated that this will be reflective of maybe how Tylee died and the fact that we do not actually know for sure how she died. It is speculated that it's going to be more like us, like assuming and guessing how she died, and more circumstantial evidence rather than hardcore evidence, because I don't think they were able to do an autopsy on her. But that was the first full week. And then that following Monday, we get started with opening statements. And so we'll go over and recap starting on that Monday, April 10th. The prosecution started with Lindsay Blake. She is a prosecuting attorney. She started to do the opening statement. Basically, her opening statement discussed how Lori's beliefs with Chad.
Didn't they also kind of pose the question that whether or not the jurors would have an issue with convicting someone of murder or whatever the charges are, without knowing how the victim was killed?
Yeah, that's kind of where the cookie analogy came into to play.
Because they did like specifically say that, you know, and then state that what the laws were, you know, whether or not you had to know how someone was killed.
Yeah, and so yes, the answer is yes. So Lindsay Blake starts off and she discusses how Lori's beliefs with Chad caused her to believe that she was a translated being and that she eliminated people in her way. Tylee had money from the Social Security benefits from her father passing away, and JJ had Social Security benefits from Charles passing away. Also had some other Social Security benefits that he was receiving due to his autism as well. And she was still collecting on that after those kids died. Tammy had a life insurance policy with Chad that was increased right before she died. And she was, of course, in the way of Lori being with her love of her life, Chad. And so she had to die. They discussed a little bit about zombies and how anything and everything that was in Chad and Lori's way, they really, really went above and beyond to fool people, to lie to people, and to get rid of quote-unquote obstacles that were in their way. And that's really what her opening statement was, and it was pretty good. Now, Jim Archibald, he is the defense attorney. He's the one that did the opening statements. And his, I would say, was a little interesting to say the least. He at first spent quite a bit of time talking about himself. Now, I do have to say, if a lawyer is not talking about the case and how there's evidence proving your your client is innocent and they're not introducing, they're not starting off their opening statement with that, and they're definitely not closing with that fact, that really just is telling that they really don't have anything. So he goes on and talks about himself, says that he's had like about 27 murder cases in like 33 years. He's a public defender. It's not an easy job. His office was bombed 8 years ago, and talked about how about 99% of the cases are usually resolved prior to ever going to trial, which I don't know where he's getting his statistics on with that.
Well, you know, like 72% of all statistics are made up on the spot.
I know, especially that one.
He is an oddball. He's a strange guy, I think. I would expect something a little bit more from her defense team.
But they have nothing, really. And I think they know they're fucked.
Yeah. Well, they, yeah. Because did he try pushing it out too, or was it just...
I think they wanted to, and they made it kind of clear and like hinted, like, we do want to push this back, but our client is not waiving her right to a speedy trial.
Right. So they weren't really pushing for it, but yeah, this guy is not, as far as what we've seen, he does not seem prepared at all.
Well, I think also you're given this, he is a public defender. You kind of have to defend what you get. And this is, I think he knows, and I think the team knows, the best thing that they could have done for her was to get her off of the death penalty, to get rid of it and to get rid of that option, which they ended up doing. And so now that that obstacle is out of the way, they know that the only thing that they can do is try and poke holes in other people's stories and create reasonable doubt, which, as we'll go on with the testimonies that have already occurred, it's going to be real difficult to do that. And we'll get more into that as we go on. But so he doesn't even really talk about Lori or mention Lori for, you know, several minutes in his opening statement. He does end up talking about how great of a mom that she is and how loving and doting she was. And of course, that was well before she went off the deep end. He even thanked the jurors for paying their taxes, because that's how he gets paid. So that's a pretty awkward statement just to throw in there, I think.
He is weird. That's all I have to say. He's a weird guy. Like, he's a character from any number of Better Call Saul or
yes,
Boston Legal.
Yeah, definitely, like, kind of reminded me of Better Call Saul. Like, he just had nothing and he just needed to say something, and that just came out.
He kind of reminds me of the public defender from My Cousin Vinny. You know, they're appointed this public defender who's just terrible. You know, he's stuttering. He just doesn't know what he's doing. He's completely out of his league. And they're like looking at each other with wide eyes, like, oh my God, like, this is what we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as he's talking about how great of a mom Lori is, he does talk about how Kay did give JJ over to Charles and Lori because Lori was a great mom with her kids. Lori's alibi is that the kids were killed in Alex's apartment, which she was not there at the time of their deaths, and she was in Hawaii with Melanie during the time of Tammy's death. So therefore, her hands are clean. And to have that as an alibi when you're being convicted, or actually when you're being charged with conspiracy, that doesn't help you at all. And the fact that you're just saying that you're not even saying that you didn't have any part in it. You're just saying, I just wasn't there, which really just isn't good enough in this case.
Because the prosecutor had also made known to they kind of taught the jurors about the law
mm-hmm.
in the state of
Idaho.
Idaho. In the state of Idaho. They had made the analogy of, in Idaho, if you rob a bank, like you could be the driver of the getaway car and you'll still be held. You could still be convicted of robbing a bank just because you were.
Yes, they did talk about that. Yes.
So, you know, if she was involved in Tammy's murder, it doesn't matter where she was because she could be on Mars. And I think her head is on Mars, frankly, but you know, she's still going to be held accountable for it. She can still be prosecuted for the murder without having done anything physically to Tammy.
Exactly.
Which is, to me, is great. I didn't know that that was the law there because from one state to another, it just varies drastically who is held accountable. You know, if you could be an accessory and maybe it's a lesser charge or something like that in another state, but it looks like everyone just kind of gets grouped in on the fullest extent of the charges if you were involved in any way, which is great in this case.
And I think it's great that Idaho doesn't allow for guilty by insanity or innocent by insanity or whatever that is. They can't play any type of insanity in this case or at all because the state of Idaho doesn't allow it. And I think that's a great thing. I think that would be their only hope for her to get off if she was anywhere else. But as the opening statement goes on for Archibald, I do think it's very interesting that he doesn't say that she didn't know that her kids were dead. He doesn't say that she really believed her kids were safe or that she was lied to by so-and-so and thought that their well-being was taken care of. There's none of that. Didn't say that she had nothing to do with planning of any of the deaths, and it really wasn't a strong opening statement. So then we get into the first witness, and the first witness is Kay Woodcock, the one who kicked off this entire thing. And I do have to say, the week before, the prosecution team, or I'm sorry, the defense team tried to actually get Larry Woodcock and Kay Woodcock kicked out of the galley. Like they couldn't be in the seats listening to the trial. They were saying that because that they had given JJ over to Lori and Charles, that they are actually no longer the grandparents of JJ. And therefore they're not victims and they are witnesses and they cannot sit in the trial and listen to the other people's testimonies.
Right. Because at that point they're supposedly not family, right? Is that what the case is?
That is the case that the defense was making.
Right. Can you imagine that? I mean, they've been through so much and just for that to be thrown at them, I mean, they have just got to be pissed off. I would be so pissed if I were them, just constantly, I would be so mad at the whole world. I'd be mad at the justice system. I'd be mad at everybody.
And they honestly, Kay and Larry have really kept it together in front of the cameras in the media. I don't think I could do that. I don't think I could be as put together as they have been. I don't even know
they
if
really
I
have,
could.
Yeah.
Talk eloquently.
Yeah.
I mean, when they talk, like you really hear the love that they had for that little boy, and it is heartbreaking. And Larry, he's really aged this whole process. It's so sad.
Yeah.
He spent his 76th birthday in trial. So, okay. So the judge, he ended up allowing Kay and Larry just to sit in the galley. And the reason how he went about this, and actually Lori's sister, Summer Shiflin, I believe is her last name, was lumped into that too. They didn't want her to listen to any of the testimony, but they allowed her and Kay and Larry to sit in the galley. And the way that they did it, it was speculated that Larry's no longer going to be a witness. So therefore he can actually sit in the galley and listen to all the testimonies. Kay was able to sit in the galley because they appointed her the family representative of JJ. Since JJ no longer has Charles, he is deceased, she is the sister of Charles. Therefore, she is the by proxy representative of JJ. And of course, his mother is the one that's on the case. She's being charged with all of this. Therefore, he doesn't have anyone else to represent him. So Kay was appointed the representative. Now, Summer Shiflin, she was appointed the representative of Tylee.
That's interesting. So because they couldn't use, because Tylee is her biological daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And so Summer is her biological aunt. And that's probably her closest relative.
No, right? it would actually be Kobe. But they already said that Kobe could be in the galley.
Were they half brother and sister? Or?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder why wouldn't the defense want Summer there?
She's actually going to be a witness for the prosecution.
Yeah.
Which I thought was very telling, but well, anyways.
Yeah. That does say a lot that her sister would, testify against her in some way.
They were so hardcore for her when all of this was going down. Like when they were looking for the kids, like she and her mother, they totally believed Lori. They went on TV, they did interviews, and then she flipped a switch.
Everyone believed her.
Yeah.
The police believed her. Everyone believed her. And it's easy in retrospect to say she's a lying, crazy, manipulative person. Like, that's easy to say, but mm-hmm. I don't know. I feel like I could have seen through the veil. The
crazy.
Yeah.
Per se. So it is rumored that there might be about 90 witnesses for the prosecution team and none for the defense team.
90 surprises me. None doesn't surprise me for a defense team.
No one wants anything to do with her. Okay, let's get into.
Well, I don't think that whether people don't want, whether she doesn't have anyone on her side or just the defense team is incompetent. I hope the defense team is competent enough to where the trial can't be, you know, if she's found guilty, that they can't appeal it due to poor representation or whatever that is called legally.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's grounds for an appeal if it's found that you're not represented very well.
Mm-hmm.
Your defense team doesn't do a good job. So hopefully they do a good enough job to not open it up for an appeal.
We'll see. Well, let's get into Kay. Okay, so Kay takes the stand. She explains that her son and his girlfriend had JJ at a time where they were addicted to drugs. JJ was born 10 weeks early, 30 weeks, lived in the NICU for several weeks. Because of the drugs in his systems, the state took custody of JJ, who was actually born Cannon. Cannon, I believe is how you say it. The state did give the opportunity to the parents, the biological parents, to get cleaned so that they can regain custody of Cannon. But that didn't happen. Unfortunately, their addiction really took over everything. So about 2 months after his birth, JJ was brought home to Kay and Larry, who the state did give temporary custody of. In February of that following year, Charles is the one who actually approached Kay asking if he and Lori could adopt JJ. Now, I always thought that it was Kay who asked him, and I was wrong about that. It was Charles who approached Kay because he and Lori actually wanted to have a child of, you know, that they had together since they had kids from other marriages. They wanted a kid to raise together. So Kay and Charles were always really close, and she really thought about it with Larry. She said it wasn't a really easy decision because they really did love him, but they did know that Charles, you know, even though he was like 5 years older than Kay, she said that he could run like circles around 25-year-olds. He just had that energy that she knew that JJ would need, and they had better special needs schools in Texas.
How old is he? Or was he?
I don't know. I don't remember.
He didn't look old at all.
No, he did age really well. I think he might have been in his 60s. I don't know. I might be wrong about that.
Really? Charles?
I think so. Or late 50s.
And Kay is younger?
Kay is younger.
But Larry must have been like, what, like 10 years older than
Kay? I don't know.
Or something?
I don't know.
Because you just said that he just celebrated his 76th mm-hmm. birthday.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I'm just speculating on all this. But I just looking at them all, he seemed like he was like in his 40s. He looked like he was in his 40s.
Yeah, he aged really well. So Charles lived in an area where there's better special needs schools. And so that would be, you know, a better opportunity for JJ. So they do take Cannon and they adopt him, changed his name to Joshua Jackson Vallow. They stayed in close contact with JJ. The adoption agreement was that Larry and Kay would maintain their grandparent role and maintain a presence in his life. And they really did, because New Orleans or the part of Louisiana that they were in and then the Houston area really are not far away from one another, about 2.5 hours. In 2019, Kate stayed with Charles for about 2 weeks to help with JJ. Lori had just up and left for 58 days. She says that she knows for a fact that it was 58 days because Charles kept track of it. He couldn't get a hold of her. He would message her, call her, beg her to at least like reach out to JJ. Like please talk to your son. He's asking for you. She was gone. It's said that she was in Hawaii at this time with Tylee may have been with her. And then she also was staying with Alex is what it is speculated. But for sure, she was in Hawaii for a little bit of that time. She said that in that time, Kay brought JJ back to Louisiana. Charles moved to Houston in that time. So this is around like late February, like March 2019. Kay started helping Charles with his business. Lori just reappeared and came back to Houston in April 2019. I believe he had dropped the divorce paperwork at that point. Then she and Charles moved to Arizona again in Chandler in June of 2019. Charles still had a house in Houston that he was at. She was renting. He actually set her up with a rental house in Chandler, and they were actually going to go through a separation at that point. She received a text message from Lori when Lori found out that she was no longer the beneficiary. Lori was angry, saying, you know, five kids and no money kind of a situation. She called from a different number. Kay did not recognize the phone number that she had called from. So at this point, remember that she actually had three phones that she had. She had like burner phones and stuff. So that's probably why she didn't have her phone number. She was calling from one of those burner numbers.
Burner phones are always a bad sign.
I know, right? So the last time that Kay actually saw JJ in person was on May 17th, 2019 in Louisiana for his birthday. She said that they went and celebrated his birthday with a pizza party. She FaceTimed about three times before his death. She said that anytime that he just got weird after the discovery of the benefits or the beneficiary of the life insurance policy was discovered by Lori. She said the situation between them and JJ really, really changed. They hardly talked to him, could hardly get a hold of her. All their FaceTimes were really short. It always looked like that somebody was actually holding up the tablet for him. And the last time that they actually did do a FaceTime, it was about 38 seconds. And she said for sure somebody was holding the tablet and then told him that he needed to get off, because very quickly he said, oh, I gotta go. Kay had made arrangements for JJ to come to Charles's memorial, but Lori and JJ never came. Lori never followed through with any of the plans, never contacted Kay. She just really just cut her off. And it's really sad that JJ never had that closure. Kay discusses that she found the Amazon searches for the wedding rings and dress and learned that Lori was married, because Lori is not the sharpest tool in the shed. She used Charles's Amazon account and whatnot to order all her shit with Chad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm surprised that Kay had access to it.
She had access to everything. So after Charles died, so she actually went to the house in Houston and, you know, allowed the sons and whoever, like, what they wanted, they can have and whatnot. So, but the, she had his like computer stuff, because, you know, yeah, the kids didn't really want it. And so she said one night around 4:30, she wakes up and she just felt like she needed to go onto the computer.
Yeah.
And so she goes on the computer and she just starts looking at stuff. And she had all of his passwords, because he actually gave it to her because she was helping out with his business. And this is when she discovers a whole bunch of stuff, like the Amazon stuff. She sees the Rexburg, Idaho, because she didn't really know where they moved to.
Most criminals slip up somewhere along the lines.
Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty good that she had access. A lot of times people won't have access to, you know, someone who dies unexpectedly's accounts. And even law enforcement, especially when you're dealing with Apple, there are some accounts that you really just can't get into. You know, like if someone has an iPhone and it's, you can't get into an iPhone if someone died. You can't like unlock it. You can't go to Apple. You can't go to the Apple store or anything like that and get into it. So not that that's the case here at all, obviously, but a lot of times that information is just good luck getting to it. So she was really, she was really on top of it. I don't think there's anything that she could have done differently, but just really too bad that, you know, Lori and Chad, if they wanted to start a new life and be crazy, do it on your own. You don't have to, no one has to be hurt, but you know, the children, leave them out of it. I know Kay and Larry would have taken both her kids, you know, anyone, her sister probably would have taken Tylee. Yeah.
I mean, I think even Kobe would have.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, it's just so, it's so stupid to me. It's so sad that something like this would happen. It's so crazy to me. It's so crazy that I cannot believe that someone believes what they believe. So for me, I'm like, they do, there's no way they actually believe that. And I think, you know, the more simple answer is that they just wanted to have a life on their own and they wanted to erase their separate lives where they weren't together and they wanted to just start over. So to me, that's like the basic answer, when they may just be batshit crazy and have these crazy beliefs, but it's hard for me to rationalize it because it's just so crazy to me.
Well, as the testimonies go on, we'll get into that, whether or not they really did believe it. So that's essentially Kay's, that's really in a nutshell Kay's testimony. Now the defense goes, and they really didn't have any significant questions. They just kind of had her reiterate some stuff that she had already said and explained, and that was it. Now, who comes up next is Brandon Boudreau. Now, who's Brandon Boudreau? Boudreau, you say?
who's Brandon Boudreau? I think I know who he is, but go ahead.
So Brandon Boudreau is actually the ex-husband of Melanie Boudreau, who's now Melanie Pawlowski. Melanie Pawlowski is Lori's niece. Lori's niece,
he's the guy that got shot at.
He is, well, thanks for taking that away from me.
I just had to prove I knew who he was.
So Melanie's mom was the sister to Lori. She died of complications of diabetes.
Nope, she was killed.
And it is actually has been said that Alex was using her credit cards in her bank accounts before she died and well after she died.
Anyone who died of quote unquote natural causes that is within 2 degrees of these people, 2 degrees of separation, was killed by one of them. That's my belief. No one died naturally around them. Tammy didn't die naturally.
Mm-mm.
Charles didn't die naturally. Alex didn't die naturally.
Well, that's what they said. The autopsy did say that.
Yeah, well, I don't believe it.
But Melanie always looked up to Lori. She really adored Lori, looked up to her like a mother figure. So they were very close. Brandon, on the other hand, this poor man has just been through it with these motherfuckers. So, as I said earlier, he is the ex-husband of Lori's niece, Melanie Boudreau, now Melanie Pulowski. They were close to Lori and Charles. They actually lived with them for a period of time. They spent the holidays together. They had Christmas in 2019 together, and that's when he noticed a shift. And at that point, he had met Melanie Gibb. Now, Melanie Gibb is a very close friend of Lori and Chad's. He said Lori and Charles' relationship had changed. Lori talked about these beliefs that we all know that she had, started introducing the beliefs of multiple lives and all this, you know, all that crap, which of course he did not believe. And he did talk to Charles about it, and Charles did say that he didn't believe it either. Now, Melanie was never really religious as to what he testified to. She started going to church more often. She started going to the temple every day and even on vacation. When they went down to Disneyland, she had to go to the temple on that vacation. Now, that's an expensive vacation.
She spent a day there, or like, what's going on?
Like, even when they went to Disneyland, she had to go to the temple at some point that day.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I don't know. Is that normal for LDS?
I don't think you really go there every day.
Yeah. So she went from not being religious really to being obsessed.
Just total switch. Mm-hmm. She starts talking about getting $10,000 worth of food storage for the end of times, which ended up causing an argument.
I bet. Like, what do you mean? $10,000. Well, first of all, I just want to say $10,000. I mean, just thinking about this from the perspective of like the type of food that you would buy, you know, to prepare for the end of the world. We're talking rice, beans, dry foods, right? Canned foods. These things are very inexpensive. $10,000 worth of beans and rice and cans. I mean, that's like a, where would you put all that?
But honey, the world's going to end, so you need to live. Okay, you need to eat.
That's fine, but $10,000 worth of beans and rice is a lot of beans and rice is all I'm saying. That's like a dump truck full.
Full of gas.
Where do you put it is what I'm saying. Like, that's a whole garage full.
Yeah, well, somebody's garage. He says that she started doing firesides with Lori and her friends, and Brandon was for sure not welcomed, and neither was Charles. Their marriage started falling apart. Melanie accused Brandon of hacking into Lori's email, which he said really came out of left field. There was no rhyme or reason for him to ever be accused of that.
Paranoid delusions.
Mm-hmm. She even accused him of being gay. Now, Charles had told Brandon, like, hey, because Charles was already getting the shit from Lori, like the crazy shit. So he told Brandon, like, you know what, be ready for her to just start accusing you of all this stuff, because they did notice that she was really believing the same things that Lori was believing. Mm-hmm. And so Charles was like, get ready for it. She's going to say some crazy stuff. She's going to accuse you of stuff. And so because his wife, Brandon's wife, is now into this because of her aunt, he did grow like this kind of like anger and like a little bit of animosity towards them as a couple. Like, you know, like, keep your shit to yourself. Like, it's like spreading into my family kind of a thing. And so he does say that he regrets that. He greatly regrets that. But then they asked, you know, where did these accusations come from, especially the one of him being gay? And there's a video of him dancing at a place called the Pink Pony in the Gulf Shore, Alabama. But the video was already on his social media, and it wasn't anything that he was holding that he was hiding.
Yeah.
It was completely innocuous. And I will say, I have been to the Abbey in West Hollywood with straight guys, and it is not a big deal.
What is the Abbey?
It is a very popular gay bar in West Hollywood. And
straight guys go there and it's okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm from the Midwest. I don't know. We don't have a lot of that.
Well, I mean, we did go with some like gay friends, but there were also some straight guys that came with us.
They're very inclusive.
Yeah.
Everyone's inclusive.
Yeah. And it's
no judging.
It's a great time.
No judging. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I've seen it on Parks and Rec. They go to a gay bar.
I'll go to the Pink Pony. I don't care.
Was it a gay bar that he was at?
It kind of sounds like it.
Well, I mean, it doesn't necessarily, just because it's called the Pink Pony or whatever, doesn't necessarily make it a gay bar.
I'm assuming it is.
Okay. Well, yeah. Because I was going to say, it doesn't make you gay to dance. Cause
no, it doesn't.
Because I'll boogie at a wedding for sure.
So stupid.
I'm like the last person standing at a wedding.
Mm-hmm. So as his testimony goes on, he speaks extremely highly of JJ and how his son Braxton, they had a good relationship together. They played together. He loved JJ and had a really close relationship with Tylee and JJ. He even baptized Tylee on her request, which is kind of a big deal, I believe, in the LDS faith.
So Brandon baptized Tylee?
Mm-hmm.
So Brandon is LDS?
Yes, he is.
But just not, he wasn't like going down the path.
No,
the same path.
He was not. Charles was also LDS
well, he
too.
He converted. Like,
he did.
He became LDS for Lori, right?
Right. But Brandon was, and I believe he grew up in the faith.
Yeah.
But he did not believe. He wasn't following any of this stuff. He didn't believe it.
It was all the doomsday stuff.
Yes.
Basically, that yes. really hooked a certain group of people.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it did. So going on in his testimony, only Charles would respond to Brandon. Lori never did. Whenever he would like reach out and ask like, what is going on? Like, you know, what is happening with Melanie? And he was upset with the both of them. Lori never responded. It was only Charles. So he did have a relationship with Charles, and he, for some time, like he really got some shit for still talking to Charles when Lori was accusing Charles of cheating on her, which we all know was a lie.
Right. Cause Melanie is pretty much like her best friend, or not best friend, but she looks up to her so much
mm-hmm. that she like wants to be her.
That it's like, yeah. Hey, how could you take Charles' side? Like mm-hmm. Lori's are, you know, between those two people, we go with Lori. We don't go with Charles.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
And Lori is again, a manipulator
mm-hmm.
and she was very good at driving wedges in between because, you know, things didn't work out between Brandon and Melanie.
Right. Yeah.
To say the least.
To say the least.
And they had a kid together, right? Just one
kid?
They
had four.
Whoa.
They have four.
How long were they together for then? Quite a while, it must be.
I mean, at least 4 years. I don't know how long they were together
for. Unless they're quadruplets or something.
So he says that the last time he talked to Charles, Charles sent an email to the family friends with concerns of Lori. In her belief, like that was like a mass email that went out. Then they get into October 2nd, 2019. And what happens on this day is Brandon drops his kids off with Melanie because they are separated at that point and they're going through a divorce. And so they're in the process of getting divorced. He sets up Melanie with a house, that's very nice of him, by the way.
Yeah.
He moves.
These men are setting up these women with houses just left and right.
He moved into a new home that only the neighbors and Melanie knew about because, again, they're going through a divorce. They have kids involved. She needs to know where her kids are. So they exchange the kids. He goes. He's coming home from the gym. Right. He sees a Jeep Wrangler with Texas plates. and the Jeep didn't have the back tire on
the spare tire there.
The spare tire on the, what is it? The trunk
on the back door,
the back door. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, a Jeep, they always have like that spare tire that's there.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't there. So then he sees a silencer come out from the back of the car. The next thing he knows is that he is being shot at. The front driver's side window is shattered. A bullet barely misses him, and he sees the Jeep just starts going, you know, starts running away. Driving away. The Jeep starts driving away.
It's kind of gruesome. Like, it was like, I'm just picturing in my head like the Flintstones. All of a sudden, there's some like feet coming out from the bottom and they're running away. So as in there were two people in the vehicle, like there was a driver and then someone shooting, or that there was just someone shooting that drove off?
It's like speculative if there was a second person. So the Jeep was parked. It was not moving. So a lot of people thought that the Jeep was in motion and moving when he was shot at.
Like it was a drive-by.
Exactly. And so that's where people were believing that there were two drivers. One would possibly be, the driver would be Melanie and the shooter would be Alex, or the driver would be some other person that Alex knows because he kind of has friends in not so great places. So that was something that we did not know, that the car was actually parked. It was not moving.
So it's as if they knew where he was going to be.
Yes. And yeah, exactly. Completely. After the gun was shot, the Jeep took off. Brandon called 911 and started following the Jeep, but the dispatcher advised him to stop following the car. That's not a good idea. So then he stops following the car. He goes back to his house and waits for police. And then he starts giving information about what happened. So he realizes that this Jeep is the same Jeep that Charles owns. It had Texas plates. He actually bought this Jeep for Tylee. This is Tylee's Jeep. And Brandon was actually once an insurance agent, and Charles went to Brandon to get a quote for insurance. And he has the VIN number to the car, and he's able to give the VIN number of the car to police. Like, wow. The irony of all of this.
Yeah. But if he had the plate number too, but that's funny that he already had all that information.
So there is footage of Lori and Chad at their storage unit. I'm pretty sure it's the day before this happened. They are putting in the storage unit a spare tire and the back seat of the Jeep. And the day after, they are putting those things back in, but it's not Lori and Chad that's doing it. It's Lori and Alex that are putting the spare tire back on and putting in the back seat for the Jeep.
Okay. So the day before, they're putting the spare tire in the storage.
Mm-hmm.
And then
the back seat. They took the back seat out.
Oh, out of the Jeep.
Yes.
Yeah. Because those things just come apart piece by piece.
Apparently.
Yeah. And then the day after, they went and picked up the back seat, put it back in, put the spare tire back on.
Yeah. And Alex, actually, his occupation was a truck driver. So he actually is trained and conditioned to be up at all hours driving. He can completely knock that drive out in that amount of time.
Oh, to drive from like Chandler or...
To Rexburg.
Yeah. No big deal. Yeah.
So Brandon talks about Googling Chad Daybell because he sees this name in emails of Melanie's, right? He sees Tammy's obituary and he just gets this gut feeling that something is definitely wrong. He then goes to the Chandler Gilbert Police Department and starts, you know, telling them about this. He stated he was in Utah when the kids were found, and the kids being JJ and Tylee. And this whole time while he's on the stand, he definitely sounds uncomfortable. He's definitely not one of those witnesses that are very animated and excited to be there. Like, he sounds extremely uncomfortable, and you could just tell, like, he's just, the shit that he has been through is really, really sad.
Yeah. He's been through the ringer. It's not anything that he, it sounds like he just wants a normal, peaceful life. You know, it's not like,
and he didn't do anything,
thrown into everything. Yeah.
He didn't do anything. And as we go on, there's more information about how it's just really sad how he was like thought so poorly of. It just doesn't make any sense. But so he was in Utah when the kids were found, and he went to Rexburg to be with Larry and Kay, which I think that's extremely nice of him. He didn't think Larry could handle identifying JJ with the state of his health. So he was actually the one who ID'd JJ's body. And he starts just breaking down, crying on the stand. The defense really didn't have much to ask Brandon. They really got hung up on the accusations of him being gay, which just tells me that they don't have anything. They didn't have anything to poke holes in, really. They just kept asking about the pink pony.
Like, anyone cares.
Right, like,
no one cares.
It has nothing to do with the case. They were just hung up on that pink fucking pony.
They should have thrown that stuff out, those questions.
I think the prosecution did object and was like, where are we going with this?
Yeah, relevance. Like, what's going on? What's the point? I think the defense guy just wanted to know where that pink pony place was.
Can you give me the address?
He wants to go investigate.
Do you know a promoter? Can get some tickets and stuff. So then Brandon is dismissed. He's released from his subpoena because he does not live in the state of Idaho. Court is adjourned for that day. That's actually day six of the trial, technically, because of jury selection. So then we get into day two. And day two, it is a doozy. And I'm going to let you know that if you are sensitive or get queasy, that you should probably skip this part. So Larry is present in court this day, and Kay is not. And with the information that is shared, it is completely understandable why she is not in court. So who comes up on the stand? It is Detective Ray Hermosillo. He is involved with the case starting November 1st, 2019. He was contacted by Fremont County Sheriff's officers about a Jeep that may be involved in a homicide. He spoke with Gilbert Police Department, who asked him to surveillance Lori's townhouse. He saw Chad and Lori together, but he didn't see any kids. They ended up seizing the Jeep on November 4th. They provided a search warrant for the Jeep on November 18th for its data system. This is when they really first heard about JJ and Tylee. Rexburg Police Department were informed that Kay was concerned about JJ, and police in Arizona were checking to see if he was there in Arizona. On November 25th, they are contacted again by Gilbert Police Department with confirmation that no, they do not have any sighting of JJ, and that they do want to have a welfare check at this townhome. So he and Detective Hope, they went to Lori's townhouse to do the wellness check. They saw Chad and Alex unloading stuff in the pickup. They asked Alex if Lori was home. Alex said that Lori was not. He informed Alex of the welfare check on JJ, which Alex just kind of had a blank stare on his face, looked back at Chad, and they were both just pretty silent. And this really started sending the spidey senses in the detectives that something was wrong. Detective Hermosillo asked where JJ was, and Alex said that he was with his grandmother in Louisiana, which Detective Hermosillo replied, well, that's interesting because that's not likely because she's the one that is actually asking for this wellness check. And so asked if Alex had Lori's phone number. He said he didn't, which they knew he was lying. He knocked on Lori's door, what they believed was Lori's door. No one was home. So then they start knocking on the doors of the neighbors, trying to figure out if anybody would tell them where Lori is or help them contact Lori. So then they start seeing Chad is leaving the complex, right? And so Detective Hermosillo stops to talk to him. He asks if, when was the last time he saw JJ? Chad says he saw him in October in Lori's apartment, number 107. Now, that's actually Alex's townhouse, not Lori's. Chad says he only met Lori a couple of times. The detective knew that he was lying because they knew that they were married at this point. Originally said he didn't have Lori's number. Eventually he ends up giving it. Chad didn't know the police knew he was married to Lori at this time. But Chad did say that he lied to the detectives because he felt like he was being accused of something. So, of course, he's not going to give them Lori's phone number because that doesn't look more suspicious.
Yeah, if you feel like you're being accused, the first thing you do is lie to the authorities. Right. Because, I mean, if you've got nothing to hide, lie. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Hermosillo called Detective Ball, who said that he was concerned with JJ's whereabouts. Detectives and police start knocking on doors through the complex. Ball and said to Hermosillo to go get a search warrant as officers waited for Lori and Alex or Melanie Boudreaux because they knew Alex and Melanie also lived in this complex as well. Police end up getting a hold of Lori on the phone, and they didn't end up getting a search warrant that day because she did agree to open the door. She was met by Detective Ball and Detective Stubbs. They do have body cams, and you can actually see this interaction on YouTube as well. Hermosillo contacted Gilbert Police Department. They still didn't know where JJ was. Another detective reached out to Melanie Gibb, who Lori said had JJ. JJ was not there with Melanie Gibb, and on November 27th, police got a search warrant for the apartment of Lori, Alex, and Melanie. They broke down Lori's door. Everything in the house was there except the clothes. All the hangers were completely empty. There was no clothes left. And he said that that was suspicious because usually if people go on a vacation or whatnot, they don't take every single piece of clothing with them. They went into apartment 107, which is Alex's townhome, and he said that that was empty as well. And I believe Melanie Boudreaux's was empty as well, too. So Lori's is the, I believe, was the only one that actually had furniture and any sign of people living in it. It was just had all the clothes were gone. In Lori's townhome, they found several guns, some of JJ's toys and his medication, empty weapon magazines, army knives, and they also found Lori's rental agreement for a storage unit, which is how they ended up finding the storage unit. They got a search warrant for that. They show pictures of Lori's townhome as they're searching. So they submitted into evidence like different angles and whatnot of what they found and different angles of the townhome. So they found a Star Wars bag. They also had like 3 to 5 preparedness bags and emergency kits. They show pictures of the empty hangers and also just a towel on the back door. Another room had Alex's belongings with the plastic tub with his name on it in the closet. In another room, there was a white hazmat suit lying on the floor. Another closet had a tub with Alex's name on it. They contacted the storage unit with Lori, which she actually signed Lori Ryan. Now, Ryan is the last name of husband number 3. It's very interesting that she didn't sign it Lori Ballow or Lori Daybell, but Lori Ryan. So it's almost like she didn't want anyone to find this. Detectives, they then show images of Lori's garage. Now, what they find are items that they ended up taking out of a tub, and it is a camouflage suit, gun magazines and silencers, clothes that are laid out on the ground, and this is what's in the pictures and evidence, several rounds of ammunition, and he says it was just a lot of ammo, a rifle and a barrel threaded for a silencer, same rifle laid down at the police station, and another rifle was inside the same bag, evidence bag. They found two silencers, which if you are buying two silencers, why, how does that not like raise a red flag?
I don't know. I don't know what the gun laws are, but I think it's probably like for recreation. I mean,
do you use a silencer for recreation though?
I don't know. Could be for hunting too. I really don't know. I don't even think they're, I never thought that they were called silencers. I thought that was an inappropriate term for it. I thought it was called like a suppressor.
Oh, no, I've only heard them as silencers. But anyways, they do find knives, handgun, a Halloween mask, which may have been used when Tammy was shot at. Inside the bag was rope and duct tape.
Was it like a Michael Myers Halloween mask? Or was it
that's
like
what it kind of sounded like.
Or was it?
That's
a general.
That's how it read. That's how I read it.
Okay.
Yeah.
A little creepy.
Right. Active passports of Alex, documents. Some were emails from Chad. They also found some of Chad's books in this garage. Rexburg Police Department then called Kobe, and he said that he hadn't seen his sister in a while. The search included then included Ty Lee. That's when they realized, oh my God, there's another kid we got to be looking for. Chad and Lori's phones were shut off. The FBI was contacted. Detective Hermosillo testifies that the police reported the kids to the National Center of Missing or Exploited Children. And it is stressed that Lori never reported her children missing. It's actually the police that did. He said that they did use tips. They followed up with every tip, and not one of them ever resulted in finding the children. They used tips and cell phone data to try and find the couple. And that's how they actually found the couple in Hawaii, was mainly from this cell phone data. He talks about on what happened on June 9th, which is the day that they found the kids. And this is where it gets really grotesque, the best way I can say it. So they go to Charles's house, and his son, Mark, answered the door. And this is about like 8:30 in the morning. They had a search warrant, and Chad was still asleep. So they go up to his room and tell him, we're going to be searching the property. He goes downstairs and they talk in the kitchen. They give him the search warrant, and Chad then calls Mark Means, who at that point was his lawyer. He asks if he needs to leave the property. They said, you can, if you do, for your safety, we're going to have somebody, a police officer, escort you. But they do notice that Chad does go outside. He goes in his car and he's sitting in his car, right? And we do know that he eventually goes and sits in the driveway of his daughter, who's like catty corner to their property, right? And he's watching them. But he does note that he keeps looking over his shoulder, and he keeps looking at the area under the tree. Now, Detective Hermosillo, he is assigned to search the fire pit area, right? Now, people are going, and people meaning like investigators and the FBI and stuff, they start going over to this area under the tree. And they notice that the grass is grown, right? It's Idaho. They have grass. They have actual landscape. But they notice that there's a very small patch of grass that is shorter than the rest of the grass. So they do know that, given that evidence, that something was dug there. So they start digging.
I'm surprised he didn't have a heart attack in his vehicle. He doesn't look very healthy in the amount of stress and anxiety and everything, because he knows what's about to happen.
It's insane. I don't know how you're not like profusely. It's disgusting. He's disgusting. So Detective Hermosillo goes and assists in the area underneath the tree. So they start excavating the area, and they expose three large rocks. And then they notice a very strong odor that, with Detective Hermosillo's training and experience, they knew that that was a decomposing body scent. They removed the rocks and found large wood paneling. They removed the soil and found a black round object, which was JJ's head. As soon as they uncovered this and they find the head, Chad starts to just book it, like at a high speed, starts leaving his daughter's residence, books it down the street. But he does not know that there were police and investigators and FBI agents. I even think Homeland Security too, they were like congregated at the church that was like down the street, just in case he tried to do anything. So there were people stationed all over the area in case he did something stupid. And they ended up, Detective Hermosillo, he goes and leaves the scene and helps arrest Chad. So Chad is then arrested, right? And he's taken into custody. Hermosillo comes back and they help get JJ out. And he assists JJ into a body bag. And before that, they did poke a little hole, like a slit, into the black garbage bag where the head area, like the crown of the head. And they saw his hair, and you know, they kind of figured it out that was definitely JJ. So he and another detective accompanies JJ and follows JJ to the morgue. And once they see that he is secured there, they come back to help find Tylee. And this is where it's really sad. So he goes back to Charles' house to help look for Tylee. So he goes to the fire pit area / animal cemetery area. Okay. They start digging and they start finding items of interest. And it's so small and like fragile that they have to really methodically extract the evidence and the items. Like they start using paint brushes to get rid of like to like brush away the dirt and whatnot. And he said that the smell was so bad that they can only work in like short amount of time, and then they had to switch out, and it took a long time to get her remains out because the smell was so bad. They did uncover pieces of Tylee, parts of her skull, her teeth, broken bones, burnt bones. He said globs of tissue that was just falling apart when they would pick her up. They carefully put her into a tarp in a body bag. There was a partially melted green bucket that had parts of Tylee in it and like adipose tissue and organs and unburnt organs that weren't completely burnt and stuff and tissue and all that. He said that they had to collect Tylee over 2 days. They, as the sun was going down, it was getting dark. The fire department lent out overhead lights to ensure that the scene wasn't going to be tampered with overnight. And there were investigators that watched the site overnight to make sure that nobody came and disturbed it.
Or even animals.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. True. I didn't think of animals. So during this time, Lori does not show any emotion, when this information is being shared. There's no tears. There's nothing. Court then takes their lunch, and when they come back, they are told that they're going to take another 30-minute break. Lori doesn't want to come into the courtroom when the remaining evidence is being shown. She knows that there's going to be pictures that are going to be upsetting. The judge says that she actually does need to stay, and Lori spends the rest of the day with her head down. She's not making eye contact. She's not lifting her head up, nothing. She just has her head like buried down. It's said that her face was red when she walked into the courtroom, and as if she was crying, and they said that you can just tell that she was very upset. And this is really the only time that she has shown any emotion. So then they show the actual pictures of Tylee's dismembered and burnt remains. So that is what the jury and the galley actually saw. And Nate Eaton on this day, so every day around 7 o'clock, he does a recap of the trial of that day. And he said that, you know, he's seen some pretty tough things in his journalist career. But this is something that he will never forget, and probably the jury will also never forget. And he got really upset when talking about that. It showed pictures of parts of a skull and a jawbone under the melted green bucket. There was more of Tylee's remains. Pictures were shown in court. Then they discussed the autopsy of JJ. Hermosillo said he saw JJ in the red pajamas. He still had his overnight pull-up diaper on. He had bruises on his arms, duct tape covering his mouth and binding his wrists together. He had a white plastic on his head that was wrapped with duct tape. His arms were wrapped in duct tape. His feet and legs were wrapped in duct tape. He was wearing his black Skechers. His head was covered with duct tape. They showed pictures of JJ in his then state. Duct tape was all over his mouth. Hermosillo said it was easy recognizing him to be the little boy that they were looking for the last 8 months. Then we have the cross-examination. It was pretty insignificant. I mean, there's nothing you can really dispute with that. He really asked, like, to reiterate much of the testimony that he had already given as to where he was at certain times, what part of the excavating of remains he was a part of, certain sequences of the day. He was asked if they found any identical wooden boards that were discovered on the property of Chad Daybell, because, as we said, there were wooden boards underneath the rocks that they found over JJ. He said, no, at that time they weren't looking for wooden boards.
For a matching set of wood paneling?
Yes.
Like someone just randomly buried their remains on Chad's property and used wood paneling that they found elsewhere or something like that?
Yeah, it's insane. Yeah, so he says, no, like, we weren't looking for wooden boards at this time. The defense really had nothing. They tried poking holes into the timeline and the testimony, but that really didn't happen. The detective really held his own and was very good on the stand. Yeah, they know they're fucked and that her alibi is just completely bullshit. So this goes into day 8. So day 8, Detective Hermosillo is still on the stand. And he asked about, you know, what tips and stuff that they followed up on. And he said that they followed up on every tip and none led to the kids. He asked Hermosillo if he knew where Lori was the time that Tammy died. He said that she was in Hawaii. Thomas asked if there was any evidence of attempted homicide on October 9th. Hermosillo said that, yeah, he actually believed that was an attempted homicide, and he has no more questions for him. And that's Detective Hermosillo. Then we have Lieutenant Jared Wilmore. He comes back. He comes on the stand. He is of Madison County of the Sheriff's Office. He oversees telemate phone system for inmates when they speak to any family or friends. He testified that he cannot edit or make any changes to these recordings. They are as is, and they are timestamped any time a call is made. Recordings from Kobe Summer Shiflett, who is Lori's sister, and Chad's and Lori's call from June 9th is entered into evidence. And they do play that phone call into on this day. So it's June 9th, and Chad is looking at investigators starting to search the property, right? He gets a call from Lori. He tells her that police are searching the property and that she should probably call their attorney, Mark Means, which Lori asks Chad, what does he want her to do? He says, pray. He says that he's getting another call. She asks him if she can call him later. He says, I don't know. I'll answer if I can. And just the way that the whole conversation goes. And of course, this is just the gist of it. This isn't the exact verbatim conversation. You can tell that he knows that they're going to find him. And he's like hinting at, hey, yeah, you should probably call Mark. You know, he knows what's going on. You should probably call Mark.
Yeah, you can try to call me, but I'm probably going to be arrested by then.
Mm-hmm. The defense has no questions with this witness. So then we have Lieutenant Joe Powell. He takes the stand. He says that Gilbert Police Department contacted him about Tammy's death on October 31st, 2019, because of the attempted murder on Brandon Boudreau. He helped with the search warrant on Alex's townhouse and exhumed Tammy's body. He helped surveillance Lori and Chad. He saw them at Cafe Rio on November 1st, 2019 in Idaho. He searched Tammy's medical records, and he only really found Prozac and Tramadol, which is a very light pain medication. Now, remember, Chad does say Tammy was falling apart, right? She was sick. She was coughing. She was fatigued. You know, she, of course, she died in her sleep. She was ill. She was falling apart. But as a nurse, I can tell you, when a patient talks to you about their depression, it's not easy. And chances are, if she went to her doctor and she talked about depression and he suggested Prozac and she starts taking it, chances are, if she was having chest pain and shit, she would have talked to her doctor. He tells people she never went to the doctor. Well, clearly this is not true. She had medication. She has prescriptions. And it's not easy talking about depression to anybody and a doctor and whatnot. And it's not easy always accepting that you might need to be on Prozac. But I don't know. To me, I just think...
Yeah, if she was talking to her doctor about depression, then chances are she was talking to her doctor about lesser things, more common things that someone is less... shielded about, like pain or like you're saying, chest pain or anything,
like something that you should, that everyone knows, like you should talk to your doctor about. You
right know? right whereas people hide their mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's getting better now, I think.
Oh, the stigma on mental health. Yeah. I think so. Mm-hmm. Too. Yeah,
but yeah, it is, it's still, you're gonna talk to someone about something physical more quickly than you're going to talk to someone about something mental and emotional.
Exactly. That's basically all of his testimony. The defense has really... Their only question really is that if he knew Lori was in Hawaii at the time of Tanvi's death, and he said, yes, he did know that. And that's really all they asked. Court was adjourned early that day because, unfortunately, Lindsay Blake from the prosecution team, she lost her father. So they called court early that day, and they didn't have court on Monday because that was when the family was going to have their funeral. So we'll take a break there. We'll take a break there because I feel like that's a lot of heavy information.
Yeah.
Next episode, we'll recap starting on April 13th, where Melanie Gibb takes the stand. But Brian, so far, what do you think of the testimonies?
It's pretty solid on prosecutors' part. You know, they're laying down solid evidence, and defense has doesn't really have anything to refute, it sounds like. And even if they did, I don't think that this public defender, it has the chops to stand up against this prosecution team. It's a pretty open and shut case. The big problem is going to be, and the prosecution did a great job at the beginning with the jury selection because they planted seeds in a good way and began educating jurors immediately on what case law is in the state of Idaho, mm-hmm. right? The big thing is always, to me, has always been, is she going to be held accountable for being a part of, you know, I think Alex was the guy who physically killed pretty much everyone. Mm-hmm. We know what Charles he was, but I think he killed the children and he's kind of been the scapegoat. The problem has always been, well, where does that put Lori and Chad in terms of their responsibility and what they can be legally held accountable for?
Yeah.
But what we learned and what the jurors potentially learned, if they didn't already know, is that if they're a part of it, they're going to go down for the highest offense too. So if she, all that prosecution has to prove is that she was involved in their deaths,
yes,
in their murders, and she's going to go down for it, whether she was in Hawaii or wherever. So, to me, it sounds like defense is trying to work against that.
Mm-hmm.
But legally speaking, like he's trying to argue against the law, right? He's trying to say she was in Hawaii, right? Well, yeah, she was in Hawaii with Tammy's death.
That's the only thing that they have.
Right. But so what he's trying to say is, well, she couldn't have done it. Well, that doesn't matter. What the prosecution's going to prove is that she was a part of it. And she's going to be, the jurors now know that she can be charged with it no matter what. So that's the big obstacle. And I think that the prosecution's doing a great job and they started early. Obviously they know what they're doing. This defense guy said, what did he say? 99.6% of all murder cases settled before trial or something like that.
Like 99%. It's some astronomical.
They're like settled before trial or they don't go to trial.
Yeah.
Or something like that. First of all, that doesn't make any sense because someone's being prosecuted for murder, I think most of the time it's going to trial. Most of the time, someone's not going to take a plea deal on that. They're going to want to try to, you know, fight it. But anyway, maybe his case is. And so this might be like the only case where like his one case out of the year where he actually goes to trial, because he probably somehow convinces everyone else that, hey, you should take a deal.
You should take a plea deal. I think they did try to get a plea deal or talk her into doing it. And chances are she just didn't take it. She thinks she's an exalted goddess and that she will prevail. And I think they know they have a difficult client. Yeah. I think they know that. I think that they know she is delusional. And unfortunately, the alibi that they have is the alibi that she once presented in her case, and they have to do that. And, you know, they're handed a tough case. This isn't a normal case. This is very different, to say the least. And as we go through more of the testimony, it was very much so that the defense just, you can tell that they just feel like they're probably over their heads with this information, and they know that this is crazy, and they know that they know she did it. I think that they know that that she did it, like in their gut, whether or not she says it or not. And I think that they know that they're fucked. And the best thing that they could have done was to get her off of the death penalty charges, which they did. And at this point, the only thing that they have is to create reasonable doubt and maybe poke holes into some of the timelines to cause that reasonable doubt. And that's all they have. And I think they're also might be hoping for some sort of smoking gun that some of the evidence may have been collected inappropriately, or just something that would just call for a mistrial.
That's really all that they can go for sure. Yeah, because there's so far in the testimony and everything that's been laid out, it's not like they, like you said, it seems like they have zero witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really have anyone on their side. They don't have anything going for them. Lori's probably not helping them at all.
But she is taking notes and she's constantly talking to them.
Yeah.
They said, and they do say that the jury is really listening and the jury's taking notes.
That's good. I think.
I think so too.
I still think that she kind of comes from a place of not so much that she is like this goddess or anything like that. I think she just thinks she's smarter than everyone else. I think that she's like feels like she can fool everyone. You know, she can make people do what she wants because that's her whole life. Really, it sounds like that's kind of like the way that it's gone with her brother. She used him to do everything, like every violent things. And she probably got her way with all kinds of other people throughout her life. And so I think that she's used to that. And so she thinks that like, she's untouchable. And I don't think it's from a spiritual perspective. I don't think she's well in the head, obviously. I think anyone who's involved in something like this, whether it be, you know, like a religious, crazy, extremist view of something or not, you know, anyone who's involved in harming children is wrong in the head. So she's just, I don't know. She's got a lot of problems. But I think that she thinks that she's better than everyone else, just in the most basic way.
Has any of the evidence shocked you so far?
Not really. No. I can't, like with how they found Tylee and JJ. JJ was, it sounds like he was found mostly intact, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I'm kind of surprised by that because I really thought that both of them would have been burned because that's just when they found the evidence, I thought that they were kind of together, like the remains were found together and under the fire pit or whatever. In that area, I guess I didn't really follow it that much at that point because it was just kind of hard to.
Mm-hmm.
It's really disgusting what they did to them.
It's horrible. Yeah.
I can't, like, it's so hard to even, like, fathom someone going through that, the children going through whatever they went through. And then, but just, like, how can someone do that to a child? How can someone just be conscious and, like, do anything like that to a child? Like, they're monsters.
It's horrible. And what those kids must have heard and felt leading up to all of this, I wonder if they were scared, if maybe Tylee was scared, if maybe she stuck around for JJ because she was afraid something was going to happen and she didn't like Chad. She probably didn't trust Chad and she wanted to keep an eye on him. And remember, she graduated high school early. She was not in high school. She wasn't in college. Like, I don't know if she had a job, but she had opportunity to not be there, you know? And just the stuff that those kids must have gone through leading up to it, it like pains me to think like the stuff that they went through and just the state that she was found in. And him being so bounded up, like, what is wrong with you? And you,
oh yeah.
And they were so close to one another. Like, you can't even give your kids the decency of being buried together. Like, you even keep them apart in death. Like, fuck you guys. It's so disgusting, the whole thing.
Yeah, and I don't understand why she is not going to be up for the death penalty.
It came down just to several things as to why it got taken off. One of them is being it would be more difficult to get a jury it's more difficult to get a jury when the death penalty is on, because then you have to have, then you go after directly into, you know, the death penalty hearing and whatnot after they are found guilty. And then it was just like a lot of other things. But then the death penalty is still on the table with Chad, and we do not have a court date for Chad just yet. And Chad's lawyer has been in, he's been in the galley like every day.
Yeah, I bet. His body's taking notes, because it's going to be the same case, really.
Yeah.
Prosecution's going to have the same thing. They were going to try him together. They were going to get the same thing.
I think they might go harder on Chad with the evidence.
Well, they'll be practiced, that's for sure. They'll know what's going to hit the jury a certain way, and it's going to be tougher for sure, because
with the testimony and the evidence that they have
his defense team will be more prepared, but so will the prosecution. Mm-hmm. I think,
like, so reading those tweets and stuff, because you can't, of course, you're not getting like an article of what's being said and stuff. You're getting tweets and bits and pieces of live updates, and you're getting these little bits of information of how, and it goes into detail about,
yeah,
like more detail about Tylee and JJ, and exact, and more descriptions of what they looked like. It was very upsetting, and it was gut-wrenching. And I remember just looking over at you and being like, oh my God, it is so bad. And to this day, the kids still have not been released to the family.
Right, legally speaking. Oh, the remains or? The
remains. They still have not been able to bury or cremate or whatever.
How does that work?
I don't know. But that's sad. So all of this information is really just a summary of all the testimonies that we've covered so far. There is more in-depth coverage and live updates from that. I have actually gotten this information from Nate Eaton from East Idaho News. I've been following his live updates. I've been following his nightly recaps of the testimonies and the days of trial. And you can also, with East Idaho News on their YouTube and on their website, eastidahonews.com, you can actually listen to the audio of the case. And you can actually hear like the voices and whatnot. Sometimes you can't hear the judge talking for whatever reason. There's times where his mic is off and the audio doesn't pick it up, but you can listen it to there and you can get more details there. I'm not going to go into every single detail because we'll never get through this.
Yeah.
So thank you guys for listening to us. I hope you have a good night. I hope you take care. Please rate, subscribe, give us 5 stars. We will see you soon with another update of the trial and the testimonies. And we hope you have a killer day.